Chapter 7. Material World. Inside the body, the bone. Under the skin, the blood. Over the skin, the fur. Across the fur, the hand. From the hand, the fire. Before the fire, the wood. Out of the wood, the tar. Held by the tar, the stone. Scraped by the stone, the red. Beneath the red, the shell. Inside the shell, the secret. Over 99% of all artifacts from the Middle Paleolithic are stone. Unlike organic things, it cannot rot. Objects made from living things, whether animal or plant, are extraordinarily rare in comparison. Teeth and bone survive better than wood, but not always. Yet such substances make up the vast majority of hunter-gatherer technologies, making it likely that there's a whole ghost realm of Neanderthal artifacts we're missing. Sometimes we see their shadows. Use wear on lithics from many sites matches wood or plants. And very occasionally, precious objects survive the millennia, testifying to the existence of lost multitudes. Until recently, these were meager clues, but the past three decades have seen a boom in discoveries. Today, wood, bone, and shell are central to new perspectives on Neanderthals as technical artisans in substances other than stone. What it tells us about their behaviour has, in many cases, been revelatory. Let's begin with wood. Few Neanderthals lived in ice-blasted wastes, and while not always abundant, trees would have been part of everyday life. Interglacial populations walked beneath spreading beech boughs, watched the blossoming gold of autumn larches, and very likely possessed as much tree lore as knowledge of stone. As early as 1911, when a spear tip was found in cliffs by the bustling seaside resort of Clacton-on-Sea, Britain, prehistorians suspected that pre-Homo sapiens hominins fashioned wooden objects. It wasn't until later that its impressive age of 500,000 to 450,000 years ago was realised. And shortly after, an entire spear appeared at Lehringen, Germany. It's huge, nearly 2.5 metres or 8 feet long. Quite thick and probably for thrusting. More importantly, it came from the Eemian and was therefore the work of Neanderthals. Like a hunter's calling card, it lay snapped into pieces beneath a huge elephant skeleton, but it hadn't been well recorded. It wasn't until 1995 that truly sensational evidence emerged for the finesse of their wood technology. A damp November day that year saw researchers from around Europe travelling to the enormous brown coal mine at Schöningen, Germany. They were drawn by dramatic claims about a dream Neanderthal site with hearths, masses of butchered animals, and wooden weapons. Lithics and beautifully preserved animal and plant remains from ancient lake deposits had been found 3 years earlier, leading to preservation of a 4,000 metre square, 4,800 yard square block of the mine sediment. As colossal machinery loomed over the archaeologists dwarfed by the surrounding pit, the post-apocalyptic scene was a far cry from the ancient world being revealed. From fine sediments within the 40-metre or 130 feet deep stratigraphy, enigmatic small wooden objects had appeared, one of which was nearly 1 metre or 1.1 yard long, with carved pointed ends. Totally unique then, it was, in fact, a harbinger. When the invited archaeologists arrived a couple of years later, scepticism was transformed to wonder. Schöningen turned out to contain one of the most important archaeological finds of the 20th century. From the dense black and grey silts of locality 1324 came proof that the apparently outlandish claims about Neanderthal weapons were true. Alongside dozens of butchered horses lay scattered the instruments of their demise, elegant, finely tapered wooden spears. Dating between 337 and 300,000 years ago, the Spear Horizon is a vaguely diagonal spread covering about 50 metres square or 60 yards square along the shore of an ancient lake. Just one layer among many at Schöningen, it alone contains over 15,000 finds. Mostly bone, there are, however, numerous pieces of wood, including, in a relatively small area, 8 fragmented spears. The most complete was only snapped in 2 places and was nestled among remains of one of the 50 horses butchered there. The spears blew apart notions of primitive Neanderthal woodworking abilities. They're far from pointed sticks. Finely crafted from thin spruce and a single Scots pine, their tips are all at the stump end, the hardest part. The shafts were systematically carved off-centre for increased strength, a trick also seen some 200,000 years later at Leringen. Weighted towards the tips, just like javelins, they were probably engineered to fly. One 2.5-metre or 8-foot spear stood out as significantly longer, hinting at a multiple weapon system. Experiments show that the shorter throwing spears easily range to 30 metres or 33 yards, and the long lance would allow precision killing while avoiding close contact with frantic prey. The Leringen spear is similarly lengthy, with a thicker base. Excavation of the jaw-dropping Schöningen deposits has been continuous since 1995, with the Spear Horizon now one of over 20 studied areas. It's possible to track Neanderthals through space along the lakeshore and through time, since archaeology is found in under and overlying layers too. Eventually, the number of spears may even increase since other worked fragments have been identified among huge spreads of splinters. But weapons aren't the only wooden objects now known to have been made by Neanderthals. New finds in 2018 from southern Europe confirmed the scope of their skill. Multiple worked sticks with single pointed ends came from 2 open-air locales. Arambalza in northern Spain, dating around 90,000 years ago, and Poggetti Vecchi in Italy, aged about 200,000 years ago. Much shorter than the Schöningen spears, their length, damage patterns and useware strongly suggest that they were digging tools, though probably also useful for prodding, poking and aiding walking. Despite seeming less exciting than spears, these artefacts were, in fact, crafted with just as much attention. This extended to raw material. One of the 2 Arambalza sticks was yew, well known as extremely hard-wearing, yet flexible wood. Famously used for the feared medieval English longbows, it was also the choice of both the Clacton-on-Sea and Leringen spear makers. Meanwhile, at Poggetti Vecchi, all 40 worked fragments of wood, representing at least 6 tools based on the number of handles, were of boxwood. Even tougher and denser than yew, this grows very long, straight branches. Hours and hours would have been needed to carve such tough wood, but the choice was intentional. Among many traditional societies, the hardest available species are selected for digging sticks precisely because they're durable. In contrast, softwoods may have been used for the Schöningen spears because no suitable hardwood was around. The technical know-how goes beyond selecting species. Just like the spears, CT scanning revealed that the Arambalza yew tool was made from off-centered heartwood. The digging sticks at both sites were carefully worked with tips ground smooth, while tiny charred traces show that fire was used to help remove bark and outer wood. There's even recycling evidence. The Arambalza stick looks like it was chopped off a longer object, perhaps a spear, while some of the Poggetti Vecchi sticks may be discarded, worn-down tools. The latter, which were found by chance during construction of a swimming pool, were in fact jumbled among a mass of animal bones, mostly straight-tusked elephant. Without butchery marks, it's impossible to prove a connection or be sure what role they played. Notably, one had a sharp tip and two others mysterious notches. But otherwise explaining their presence is difficult. The objects mentioned so far were used out in the landscape and clearly sometimes linked with hunting. Did Neanderthals have other kinds of wooden tools? In northeast Spain is an enormous rock shelter known as Abric Romaní, which has produced some of the most important data on Neanderthals in the past three decades. When excavations began in 1909, there was little indication that an astonishing archive lay concealed beneath its attractive yet ordinary travertine overhang. In fact, it's the same calcium carbonate waters which formed the overhang that make this place special. Layers of flowstone were repeatedly deposited across the floor of the rock shelter. Each covered the detritus from Neanderthal occupations, conserving it in breathtaking detail. Once would have been amazing enough, but this happened at least 27 times across 12 layers, spanning 40,000 years. Hundreds of hearths, many tens of thousands of lithics and bones are preserved alongside perishable things like leaves, pine cones, and carbonized wood. Other wooden objects rotted, but left impressions behind cast in flowstone, Middle Paleolithic equivalents of the Pompeii bodies. Abric Romaní holds a totally unique record of the stuff left by Neanderthals each time they moved on, including 100 or so wooden objects across multiple layers. Mostly fuel for fires, some are worked artifacts. At least one resembles the Arambalza stick, but others are very different. Two carbonized, gently curved objects from a layer aged between 50 and 45,000 years ago look very much like wooden platters, somewhere between the diameter of dinner and side plates. Another was flat, but with a long protrusion at one end, possibly providing a handle. The most remarkable find came in 2011 from a level dated around 56,000 years ago. While yet to be published, press releases showed a large cleaver-shaped tool complete with flat blade and handle, exactly as you might find in the kitchen of a keen chef. It presumably served to slice soft things and stunningly shows the role of wood technology in everyday Neanderthal domestic life. Joinings. Neanderthals were indisputably carpenters, but they also pioneered composite tools. The technological echelon, represented by assembling multiple parts into one object, gives greater control, more shock absorption, and saves time and energy, since it allows modular repairs. Composite tools mostly have an active stone part, the business end, and a handle or haft. Some Neanderthals may have used simple wedged handles, but in other cases, useware points to bindings, probably sinew and tendons, or even plant fibres. And amazingly, some ancient adhesives have survived. Suspicious black residues on Middle Paleolithic artifacts from Syrian sites turned out to be 50,000-year-old bitumen, a ready-to-stick natural asphalt. Neanderthals elsewhere also spotted its usefulness, shown by residues found in 2012 at Gura Cei Rasnov Cave, Romania. This finding makes chemical identification of bitumen or oil shale in dental calculus at El Sudrón especially intriguing. Moreover, as the same individual had severe tooth chipping, he may have used his mouth to manufacture or repair hafted tools. Even more complex demonstrations of Neanderthal hafting technology exist. In the 1970s, archaeologists excavating another German brown coal mine at Königssaar found two small black lumps from a lakeside occupation, dating around 85 to 74,000 years ago. One had certainly been part of a composite tool. Three surfaces bore imprints of a lithic tool, a wooden surface, and the unmistakable whorls from a partial Neanderthal fingerprint. It was only in 2001 that chemical analysis identified unique biomarkers from birch trees, specifically tar derived by cooking the bark in low oxygen conditions. Today, at least two other examples of Neanderthal-made birch tar are known, widely spread in time and space. One was dredged from under the North Sea before being picked up on an artificial Netherlands beach. A sizeable lump of birch tar still half covering a flint flake, it was directly dated to around 50,000 years ago, and quite astonishingly comes from the same submarine zone that produced the Zeeland Ridges Neanderthal skull fragment. Over a decade earlier, an almost identical object, together with another smeared lithic, had been found in river gravels at Campitello, Italy. They're far older, taking back this technology to the early Middle Paleolithic, around 300,000 to 200,000 years ago. As yet, unidentified lumps and potential hafting substances exist at a number of sites, but the most spectacular and surprising case was published just in 2019. Very small flakes from Fossalone Cave and Sant'Agostino Cave in Latium, Italy, have residues from pine or conifer resin. Both are roughly the same age, around 55 to 45,000 years ago, but in technological terms, one is far more complex because it's mixed with beeswax. Pine resin is less shock resistant than birch tar, but experiments show that adding wax makes it nearly as good. Dripping from bark and scenting forest air in warm regions, pine resin is easily noticed. Simply leaning on a trunk for balance can leave you covered in the sticky stuff. But what about beeswax? As Chapter 8 will discuss, Neanderthals may well have had an appetite for honey that perhaps led to their investigation of wax as a substance. Its inclusion in a hafting adhesive recipe is testament to their concern for material quality and an ability to experiment and innovate. But just how common was hafting in Neanderthal life? Hafting polishes are found on many artefacts that aren't weapon tips, from retouched tools to ordinary flakes. Impressively, almost half of sampled artefacts at the northern French open-air site of Biache-Saint-Vaast had hafting micropolish, while work on Syrian bitumen sites in some cases suggests around a third had residues. The many small flake and bladelet systems would make sense as hafted objects, and then there's also conifer resin, possibly heated, from at least one individual's calculus at El Cidron. It may be that, at least for some Neanderthals, composite tools were far more quotidian than the rarity of their archaeological traces would lead us to believe. The scarcity of preserved plant remains long hampered our understanding of their use by Neanderthals. But the role of other more tenacious organic materials has also only recently been appreciated. This includes shell, the biomineral properties of which are in some ways similar to stone. Very rare Lower Paleolithic shell artifacts exist, but from 120,000 years onwards, Neanderthals developed true shell-based technologies. So far, 13 sites, all in Greece and Italy, have produced several hundred worked shell tools. At Cavallo Cave, southern Italy, in addition to some fragmented pieces across various layers covering some 10,000 years, the richest level is Eemian, with over 120 retouched shell parts. And in the same region and period, Neanderthals at Moserini Cave also produced shell tools. Along with unretouched fragments, 170 certain tools came from a very small excavated zone. Once again, shell tools show how Neanderthals were choosy about their materials. Smooth clams, Callistocione, were especially favoured, being a decent palm-filling size and with striking glossy surfaces. Similar species, though, were hardly used, while mussels at Moserini may have been eaten, but were never nabbed. And even though smooth clams are edible, there isn't always evidence that they were food waste. At some sites they were collected from beaches, but at Mosherini almost a quarter look as if they were ferreted out fresh from the sands. Why use shells? They offer naturally ergonomic blanks, but being blunt, they require retouching to create an edge. And though they dull faster than stone, shell tools are auto-renewable. Neanderthals could freshen up edges simply by briefly using the tool on a hard material. Some species are also surprisingly robust, and use wear confirms that they were cutting meat and skins in addition to scraping wood. Most come from Kena-like assemblages, and it seems that Neanderthals noticed the resemblance between such flakes and the long curved edge and shorter back of shells. They certainly were able to apply the same technical know-how. The unusually strong force needed for Kena retouching is also essential in shell napping. Even the gesture is similar. What all the shell sites have in common is local scarcity of high-quality rock. With Neanderthals forced to use porous stuff, including very small beach pebbles. Clear economising was going on, with the shells being broken up to gain small, immediately usable pieces, each of which could then also be resharpened. In other cases, however, shell was sourced from up to 15 kilometres or 10 miles away, which starts to look more like a preference. One riddle remains. Why are shell napping sites not found outside the central Mediterranean? Smooth clams today are abundant farther west and right around the Atlantic coast, though perhaps less so in glacial periods. Nevertheless, the absence of shell tools in Iberia is odd, given that Neanderthals were certainly foraging on seashores, as we'll see in the next chapter. Perhaps some shell assemblages are in those now sunken sites, where denizens of dark sea caves may be sliding over ancient napped remains of their relatives. From stone to bone. Neanderthals, of course, had access to a third, far more abundant organic resource for toolmaking. Animal bodies connected two great pillars of their lives, technology and subsistence, both in the hunt and afterwards as raw materials. For decades, the orthodoxy claimed that antler, ivory or bone tools were virtually absent from the Middle Paleolithic, such that they became markers for the emergence of modern Homo sapiens behaviour. Thanks to advances in analysis combined with shifting expectations, today's prehistorians have uncovered a very different picture. The Neanderthals emerged from a lower Paleolithic world where animal remains were already entangled with the production of lithics, but they both amplified and transformed these early traditions. Their forebears well understood the utility of bone or antler hammers for the shallow flaking techniques needed to make bifaces. But the dawn of the Middle Paleolithic saw a shift where entire bones or big hunks began to be replaced by smaller shards, especially from limb bone shafts. Mostly used for final shaping, retouching and resharpening of tools, in some sites they're extraordinarily numerous, yet absent in others. Growing research into these objects, generically labelled as retouchers, although this could also imply resharpening, has unlocked fascinating details about Neanderthal technical skill and traditions. Outstanding evidence of the ascent of bone tools comes from the spear horizon at Schöningen. From an area of just 50 metres square, or 60 yards square, there were 15 massive bone hammers, some of which bore damage showing they'd also been used to smash other bones for their marrow, many of which had previously themselves been used to resharpen lithics. Hammering and retouching require specific levels of force and knowledge of how to heft and where to aim. So, although early Neanderthals at Schöningen were obviously using large bones for different tasks, they weren't yet preferring shards for particular activities. Nonetheless, there is clear selection in the kinds of bones. At Schöningen, horse carcasses were available in abundance, and their lower limb bones, known as metapodials, were definitely preferred for tools especially multi-use objects. Metapodials aren't very meaty, but their thick, strong, flat shafts are perfect for spreading percussive energy. Within 100,000 years across the early Neanderthal world, bone technology becomes more refined. Metapodials are still favoured, but rather than whole bones, it's almost always shards being used. Research at Les Pradelles, France, a sinkhole formed by a collapsed cave, exemplifies how systematic Neanderthals had become. Recent reinvestigation of immensely rich Kina layers dating between 80 and 50,000 years ago has so far identified some 700 retouches. Two-thirds come from just one assemblage, where they're twice as common as lithics. As hunters, Neanderthals were intimately familiar with the physical properties of bone and variation between species. At Les Pradelles, most of the butchered animals were reindeer, yet Neanderthals here preferred bigger beasts for their retouches. Horse and bison bone tools are twice as abundant as would be expected. A similar predilection for larger species is seen in many other sites. For example, where roe deer was mostly hunted, less common moose or aurochs bones were selected. Beyond species, the body part was also considered. Rear limbs seem to be the equivalent of flint for lithic artifacts. Neanderthals typically preferred them, but could be flexible if necessary. Back at Les Pradelles, for example, there are exceptions to the metapodial retoucher rule, since occasionally jaws, shoulder blades, hip bones, ribs, and even toes were used. In other contexts, extremities rather than shafts of big limb bones were chosen, harking back to the early Middle Paleolithic. But elsewhere, it was very different body parts, horn cores, horse teeth, and even at the vast cave of Kulna, Czech Republic, mammoth ivory. Carnivores weren't scorned either. Among sporadic saber-toothed cat remains from Schernigan, an upper forelimb in the spear horizon was used both as a hammer and retoucher. Pickiness about size even extended to the bone shards themselves. A decent length was needed to achieve the right flick of the wrist retouching gesture. And so Neanderthals consistently chose pieces over 5 centimetres or 2 inches long. The average length of retouches at Les Pradelles is nearly double that of unused bone fragments. Neanderthals had exactly in mind what they wanted and wouldn't settle for any old splinter. In at least some sites, they were taking out the good bits during butchery rather than sifting through random piles of waste, which makes sense as fresh bone is stronger and more elastic. New refitting work shows this at microscale. At Skladina, Belgium, while smashing a butchered bear femur for marrow, a Neanderthal carefully picked out only the 4 longest shards to use as retouchers. Despite being excellent judges of quality, however, Neanderthals sometimes made unexpected retoucher choices. Like many sites, the spear horizon at Schöningen is a palimpsest of occupations. So, the fact that about 75% of all the bone tools are from the horse's left side is remarkable. It may be something to do with how grip and gesture work better for right-handers using left-sided bones, but what's important is that this was an intentional choice. We can even get a hint that Neanderthals had particular tasks in mind for some retouchers. Incredibly detailed analysis of the location, shape, and nature of damage reveals that larger and thicker ones are more heavily used. As the battering changed the bone surface from flat to concave, nappers shifted to different zones, sometimes as many as 5 times. The surface of retouchers was often scraped prior to and during use, and at Le Rosel, northern France, scraping is more common on retouchers used multiple times, suggesting Neanderthals took more care preparing tools that they expected to use for longer. One remaining puzzle exists. While individual retouchers were more intensively used in some techno-complexes, especially Kina, there's no obvious explanation for why some sites have huge numbers but others hardly any. Local quality or availability of stone doesn't seem related, and nor does the number of retouched lithics, age of the site, its function, or the animals hunted. The answer may be that these retouches were tied to contexts and dynamics that are archaeologically elusive, such as the site's place within a wider occupation cycle or the social makeup of group members. Retouches are by far the most commonly found sort of organic tools, but Neanderthals also used bone in other ways. Consistent crushing damage on the ends of some limb bone shafts suggests they were used perhaps for indirect lithic knapping, where a piece of bone acts as middleman between core and hammerstone, focusing the force. Other bones with smooth or polished surfaces have clearly been used to rub materials in different ways. Sometimes this is visible on retouches, but mostly plain bone shaft fragments. At Schöningen, Neanderthals were intensively using sharp bone tool tips on medium-hard materials, possibly even as knives to cut tough muscle fibres. Other pieces there, including a fragment of ivory, had been slowly worn smooth and even bevelled from rubbing on softer stuff, probably animal hides. Detailed analysis on larger assemblages elsewhere has managed to sort different bone tools according to the type of damage and direction they were moved in. Comgonal, some have scratches parallel to the long axis and wide polished ends, while shorter fragments with pointed ends display very different sideways wear patterns. Exactly what any of these were used for is unknown, but Neanderthals were obviously selecting bone tools by task. Just like shell, bone was also occasionally knapped and shaped. This practice has Lower Paleolithic roots, though how often Neanderthals did it might be masked because bone is so often damaged by carnivores or other natural processes. Knapped mammoth tusks, however, do tend to stand out. 19th century excavations at Barma Grande, one of several rich coastal caves on the Italian-French border, uncovered still connected remains of a butchered young mammoth, whose tusks seem to have been split and flaked. At Axla, northern Spain, bone fragments appear to have been retouched into scraper and chisel edges, with use wear indicating they were used for hide working. In other contexts, Neanderthals even knapped bone retouches and other tools to alter their outline. Strong evidence for desired forms as well as properties. Did Neanderthals also make weapons from bone? Maybe. Some of the best candidates come from Salzgitter Lebenstedt, Germany, a rich open-air reindeer kill site dating to at least 55 to 45,000 years ago. There are more than 20 shaped bone artifacts here, including mammoth ribs flattened into points around 0.5 metres or 1.5 feet long. The most remarkable and totally unique object is a wedge-shaped point made from reindeer antler. Its conical tip and chamfered base recall nothing so much as the business end of a hafted weapon. Only 6 centimetres or 2.3 inches long, it would work as a light spear point, or just possibly a dart or arrowhead. The latter technologies are almost universally assumed to have been invented by early Homo sapiens, but they are hinted at by lithics in one other Neanderthal site, which we'll explore in chapter 15. Otherwise, Salzgitter remains the only candidate for Middle Paleolithic bone weapons. Tools to mines. The range of organic and lithic technology we now know Neanderthals employed has ballooned, but what does it tell us about them? Leagues beyond the most complex primate, bird, or other animal toolmakers, their expertise, even compared to more ancient hominin ancestors, is striking. While Levallois was long viewed as a cognitive pinnacle for Neanderthals, similar levels of sophistication are involved in the other lithic technocomplexes, even if they functioned rather differently. All demanded excellent control of knapping mechanics and an ability to sustain a multi-stage project requiring foresight. Over the past three decades, the clear trend is for technological lines between Neanderthals and early Homo sapiens to grow fuzzier. Even if not always abundant, supposedly modern things, like bone tools, were far from absent. The only lithic techniques seen in the contemporary African Middle Stone Age, but not visible in the Neanderthals' Middle Paleolithic, are controlled heating to improve stone properties, and the pressure notching technique for creating serrated weapon tips. In fact, these are far from widespread, and cognitively aren't radically different to other things Neanderthals were doing. Given the obvious craftsmanship in the Schöningen spears and other wooden objects, we must surely now be thinking of Neanderthals as carpenters. Such objects actually mean greater investment of time and energy than any biface or even a Levallois core. And although bone tools are generally less heavily worked, they show that Neanderthals' concern for selection and quality extended across all raw materials. They were among the first to fully recognise that animal bodies offered more than food. Carcasses were increasingly treated like bone quarries, and using retouches both drew on and deepened knowledge of animal anatomy. Retouches not only enabled more specialised lithic tools, but also massively boosted resharpening and therefore the usable life of artefacts. The production of hafting substances takes things to another level. Birch tar drops can form fortuitously from bark in campfires. But to gain usable amounts, Neanderthals needed to maintain careful control of the fire's temperature for extended periods. Moreover, the chemical purity of the North Sea tar supports the idea that by 50,000 years ago, Neanderthals had significantly finessed their technique. Add to this the way Neanderthals obviously aimed to improve the natural quality of pine resin by adding beeswax, and you have cognitive complexity equivalent to the plant, gum, and mineral hafting recipes known from early Homo sapiens sites in southern Africa. Composite tools in themselves also imply impressive mental capacity to plan, design, and anticipate. They bring together multiple episodes of material sourcing and manufacture for each constituent part, even before their assembly. And renovation is built into the very nature of composite artefacts. Worn-out stone edges were replaceable, but handles were likely much longer lived and far travelled. The adhesives were themselves probably carried around. A second piece at Königssaar had been rolled and folded carefully by a Neanderthal, but potentially manufactured elsewhere. The more we look, the more we see that many of the things Neanderthals made moved considerable distances. Tree ring data shows that the Schöningen spruce spears certainly weren't carved by the lake, but felled in summer at higher altitude, probably in the nearby Harz Mountains. One spear tip even showed signs of repair to damage likely sustained in another hunt, perhaps for beasts other than horses. So far, there's no hard data that bone tools were transported. But considering Neanderthals would have needed to resharpen lithics while on the move, they probably were. There's an intriguing hint from the rock shelter of El Salt, Spain, where bone retouchers seem to have already been old when used. And anomalous species might also reflect this. A giant deer retoucher from Moulin-Guercy in southeast France had obviously been sourced from a butchered and smashed bone, but it's the only representative of this animal in the layer concerned. If many things were carried, can we imagine Neanderthals having their own possessions? Items that took significant time to make, like digging sticks, or that fitted a particular body like spears, were likely recognised as belonging to the individuals who produced them. If this is the case, did most Neanderthals develop the skills needed for a wide range of objects and materials, such as those in a composite tool Or could these artifacts embodying multiple levels of know-how have been communal projects? We may well be looking at the emergence of craft specialists in at least some of the technical realms of knapping, wood carving, adhesive production, and other activities like hunting or hide working. Perhaps one artisan has already been found. Chemical analysis of the El Cidrón 1 adult male found traces of bitumen in his calculus. The only likely explanation is using his mouth in composite tool manufacture or repair, boosted by the presence of intense chipping on his teeth and plant residues. This is also a reminder of the lacunas in the archaeological record, as, without the chemical analysis, we would have no idea that bitumen was probably being used from Iberia through Eastern Europe and as far as the Near East. It seems unlikely that individual Neanderthals developed their sophisticated technologies without social learning contexts and reasonably elaborate communication. Modern knappers may sometimes self-teach, but that typically requires some kind of textbook, if not video tutorials. Tool-using primates learn largely by observing and copying, but the range of skills and great accomplishment across diverse materials demonstrated by Neanderthals strongly implies some sort of teaching, matching the fact that directed instruction is common to all living humans. Combined teaching by showing as well as telling is the most effective, and young Neanderthals likely learned not in a formal way, but by cultural and bodily immersion. They would have heard how a cobble with good structure calls out when struck, felt with their body the right angle and force to hit a core, just so. Youngsters bashing stones together must have created echoing choruses around sites as their hesitant rhythm wove through the more confident strikes of elders. This context of intergenerational learning is vital for maintenance of cultural traditions, which for Neanderthals are discernible beyond the obvious lithic techno-complexes. The Central Mediterranean shell-knapping tradition, or birch tar technology, extending across tens of millennia and three regions in Europe, are other examples. At a micro scale, Schöningen also implies cultural traditions. Time and time again, the hunters returned to exactly the same part of the lakeshore, chose the same tree species for their almost identically made spears, and used particular parts of the horses they killed as tools. While minds create things, things also create minds in a manner that extends far beyond the individual or even the generation, and can transform whole species. For Neanderthals, new experiences or encounters opened up fresh ways of thinking about the world. It's not a stretch to suggest that their technological innovations probably impacted other aspects of their lives. Composite tools are a case in point. The inherent process of joining together must have reinforced concepts of connectedness and collaboration, crucial for hunting and social networks. And since composite tools are made up of materials connecting different places and times, these objects had a unique capacity to act as potent mnemonics, expanding the vistas of memory and imagination. Birch tar itself suggests other interesting ideas. To comprehend that bark would transform to sticky, pungent black liquid essentially means grasping that matter could transmute. Rather than being destroyed by fire, it would be utterly remade. Alchemy is a loaded term, yet Neanderthals certainly had concepts not far off this. As tar was cooked, cooled, and solidified, then was reheated and softened once again, so cycles of change were witnessed and understood. We see similar radical physical transformations from ores to liquids and finally solids in substances called metals, which wouldn't be invented until many tens of millennia later. When we regard Neanderthals on their own terms, we perceive that they were fundamentally experts as well as experimenters. Deep knowledge underlay discerning material choices and targeted planning. As connoisseurs of the crafts they were immersed in every day, Neanderthals combined convention with adaptability. They invented new ways to take things apart and join them together. The impacts of this spiraled outwards and underpinned the way Neanderthals lived increasingly complicated lives and expanded their activity in the landscape. This mental fluidity allowed them to adapt to whatever situation arose, creating novel forms of production, use, and rejuvenation, while engaging with and exploring the world and everything in it in richer ways than ever before. But to do all this, they had to eat.